First of all, I want to say a very heartfelt thank you to all of you who, in response to the fact that while we were gathered here last Sunday morning, unbeknownst to the members of the family that were here, our home was on fire. And so that's what we came home to, more or less. I'll kind of flesh that out a little bit. But so many of you have been very kind in your responses, really, really caring. It's been a lovely thing to experience, that aspect of this. So thank you, and thank you too for, in so many cases, for the sensitivity with which you've expressed your care. This extension without a requirement of a response, that's lovely. It's a lovely way to be cared for when you feel like all of your resources are being assigned elsewhere. And you really would like to respond and just know that it's not going to happen. And so if there's a lesson already to anyone who's new to caring for people in crisis, take this one home. Extend care and don't expect anything back. In fact, if you say, don't need to respond to this, just know that I'm thinking about you, you're already rocking it. And that's a good thing to learn. And sometimes the kind of things we only learn when we're, you know, when we have to deal with this sort of thing. What I want to do this morning is I'll just recap the story for you so that we can enjoy one another's company a little better after the service, and rather than having everybody occupied with hearing the same story over and over again, because people care and they ask, and I love that. Thank you. But let me just try to be efficient about that part as well. And it is kind of a fun story in certain aspects. I haven't entirely lost my sense of humor in this, but it's gotten dark and twisted. Darker, more twisted. Anyway, basically what happened is a bathroom fan, for those of you that care about these things, an exhaust fan started the fire, so the fire was immediately located in the ceiling and attic of the home, which is a very dangerous place for a fire to be because it can travel unhindered in that space. Davis and Kale were at home. Everybody else was here. And they heard the local alarm in the house go off, and they were not especially troubled by that because our alarm goes off once in a while. We heat with wood, and so every once in a while the alarm is sensitive to those realities and thinks there's a fire, and there is, but it's in the fireplace. So they weren't too distressed, but they thought they'd better follow it up, so they started looking around the house, and they weren't finding any fire until they got to the very far corner of the house, which is the master bedroom and ensuite. And when they went into that space, they noticed some smoke, and they just kind of kept following the trail of the smoke until they got to the ensuite, opened the door, and there was a pile of towels on the floor on fire. They thought, well, that's a little odd, but we can deal with that. So kind of basically fired up the shower and put out the fire on the towels. And having done that, they kind of stood back from their handiwork and observed that there was still an awful lot of smoke continuing to pour into the space. At which point, and this sounds funny, but until you're in a crisis, you don't realize how hyper-focused you can be. Then they looked up and saw the 3-foot hole in the ceiling that had already burned and fallen down and lit the towels on fire. And towels were a casualty, not a cause. And then they realized this was serious. By this time, the alarm company had received the signal, and they phoned and said, do you need the fire department? The boys answered that question correctly. Actually, Davis and Kale were awesome in this. I'm just so, so proud of them both. So they said, yes, please send the fire department. The fire department locally is volunteer, so that's a page and come on out kind of thing, because we're in the country. Intriguingly, the fire chief is a good buddy with a neighbor of ours, and they were like 3 times the distance of this building away, more or less, having breakfast together at his buddy's place, and they hopped in the truck, came right over, immediately realized they needed some help, called in the big guns, and so we had help there in terms of the fire department very quickly. Between Davis and Kale's response, the alarm company's response, and the volunteer fire department's response, one way to sum up the good news there is we still have a home. I think without those variables, it would have been over because of where the fire was in terms of the loss. So we're grateful for that. Davis and Kale, having summoned in the big guns, realized they know enough about fires and how this can go because we have family friends who a couple of years ago lost their entire home and contents, and so we've been close to this as a family, not that far distant in the past. And they kind of knew that, and so they decided they better get the precious things out of the house. So the first thing they did was open the front door and throw Mika out. And Kale insists, if we tell the story that way, and I use the word throw, he's like, I didn't throw her, he said to me the other day. Dad, I didn't throw her out. She was no higher than the seat of a chair when she went out the door, and she jumps down off chairs all the time. So I think it was like, Mika just out the door, onto the front lawn, front snowdrift. And then they went back in for the guitars. Yeah, those are my boys. And so, anyway, so they got all the guitars and the instruments out of the house onto the front porch. So there's all these, there's some lovely instruments in our house. And so there's this like heap of guitars, you know, sitting on the front porch. Anyway, then they went back for the hard drives and the computers. Then they went back for the legal documents. Then they went back for the art. So I think they did well. And the art included, and this was just like one of those, oh, you guys are awesome. They went to Taya's room and rescued her two favorite dolls. Isn't that sweet? You know, that's lovely, okay? They went to Tyrion's room, and he has a couple of medieval replicas that he's made together with his grandfather. Very precious to him, and that's what they rescued for him. And they knew they didn't have a lot of time. And they were right. The fireman got there and said, no more. You're not going back in. And so that was what they were able to take out of the house. And by the time I got the phone call, which wasn't until I was more or less done cleaning up, or pretty close to done cleaning up here, it was from Davis at the Concordia, where they'd been taken by the ambulance to be checked out for smoke inhalation. So that's how I heard about the house. Davis's opening line, Dad, there's a little problem with the house. Anyway, I appreciate understatement as well as hyperbole, and I thought that was a masterful moment of understatement. There's a little problem with the house. Where are you? I'm at the hospital. Anyway, we went on from there. We were planning to have lunch together with my parents and my sister, who were visiting, before they all went home, either later on Sunday afternoon or Monday morning. And so grandparents and children were already en route to that gathering, and Queen and I sort of detoured. I went by the hospital, and she went to the house. And we were very quickly aware that this was no longer a place where we could live in the interim. And so we had to solve that problem. We normally watch over our neighbor's home in the winter. They spend winters in Mexico. Tough for them. But it's just a matter of popping over every 2 or 3 days and, you know, making sure everything's okay. So what we did was moved in to their home right then. So we live next door. We now are in that unique strata of society of people who have two homes. They're both winter homes at the moment. They're both lovely in their own way. They don't smell the same. But it's kind of unique. And one of those things where we couldn't have, had we been trying to plan for a disaster, we couldn't have made a better plan than that. We weren't trying to plan for a disaster. It's how it went. And I'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go. As a pastor, I often have occasion to be welcomed into other people's suffering. And I cherish that. It's a real honor for me to be trusted with sharing those parts of the journey with other people. It does tend, though, to foster a certain perspective on those things when most often you find yourself in your life experience on the caregiving end of those stories. And I thought what I would do this morning is talk a little bit about what's been stirred up in me by having the other perspective, by being, if you want, on the other side of that coin. Our culture uses words like disaster for what we've just experienced. And I appreciate the concern that a word like that comes with. I appreciate what it reflects. And I think it's nonsense, really, to compare suffering with some kind of mathematical grid. Everyone's suffering is unique. But if I use those kind of terms in this situation, I would like you to know that I use them advisedly. There's so much more that falls under that label that is so much more horrific than this that it almost feels unfair to use that language. But there are some things that this situation has reminded me of that I've been thinking about, well, that's good. Those are good things to be reminded of. And one of the things that this situation has reminded me of is of the everywhere present nature of God. One of my literary mentors is Henri Nouwen, and Nouwen is the person that I remember first teaching me the idea that only the followers of Jesus carry the presence of Jesus to others is too small. That was not a very good sentence, but Let me try it another way. Now is the person who taught me that if I think that only the followers of Jesus carry the presence of Jesus to others, my thinking is too small. And this situation has reminded me of that lesson over and over again, that there are so many ways that the beauty of the presence of Jesus can be carried, even by those, sometimes especially by those, perhaps, who don't name the name of Christ as significant to their spirituality. It's a very common Christian theology that within the Trinity, it is uniquely the person of Christ that is the Creator. And that's a fairly enduring Christian theology. That one survived quite a few bumps along the way. One of the upshots of that, though, is that all that is made bears the imprint of the Maker. And so, to the degree that we regard that Christian story of Christ as the Maker of all that is, the Creator of all that is, and that we regard all that is made as bearing some distinct impression of its Maker, why would it be such a tremendous surprise that we would find Christ born to us by people other than those that espouse Christ as Lord, Savior, Master, God, and those that don't? Or those for whom, when we encounter them, we have no idea, this way or that way, of their belief about this matter. That idea, and Nouwen takes it pretty far. Nouwen would simply say, and he's usually writing when he writes about this, to people who are Christians and who are in ministry, who are actually doing something day by day, consciously in the name of Christ. He would just say that it's in the faces and lives of those we care for that Christ comes to us. And that we need to pay attention to that if we really want to understand anything like the fullness of the presence of Christ in the world. I walked into Tyrion's bedroom the other day. The restoration company we're working with has been fabulous. They've just been wonderful. And so they're working their way through the back end of the house first and then sort of out through the whole place to try to eradicate the smoke damage and the smell and so on. So I walked into Tyrion's room the other day, and there was this woman sitting in the middle of his floor. And a little backstory, maybe, because not all of you have visited Tyrion's room. Tyrion has probably almost the biggest bedroom in the house. And one of the reasons for that is because he needs 2/3 of it for his Lego. And there's this big rug, and it's just covered all the time in Lego. And there's always some world-making going on in Tyrion's room. Pretty elaborate, big world-making sometimes. He can spend a lot of time in there. And of course, that was all in there when the fire happened. And I walked into his room, and there's this woman sitting in the middle of the rug, surrounded by his Lego and these big buckets of soapy water, and she's cleaning all the Lego. I know. And she looks up at me. Okay, this is the part. Thanks for the cleaning, Lisa. You knew this was going to happen. She looks up at me and she says, I found Legolas, but I can't find the hobbits. He must have taken the hobbits with him. They're not here. I'm like, what? And she was right, of course, you know. And she said, he must have just gotten this for Christmas. It's a new set. Turns out she has an 11-year-old and, you know, and so on. But I kind of had to back down the hall and catch my breath, you know, because it was a kind of attentive care that, I mean, she's getting paid to scrub Lego bricks, you know, not to think about my kid and their experience of loss and to wonder where the hobbits are. It's just a pile of bricks, right? Not to her, man. Not to her. And she said, I want you to tell him we're cleaning all the Lego, but I'm not taking apart any of his creations. And she knew what he had made, what was kind of the custom part of this. She said, he'll have to, and this was her language, this is not my language. She said, he'll have to remake his world, but I won't take apart any of his creations. Whew. How about that? Okay, I don't have to travel any further than that, you guys, to see the face of Christ. All right? That kind of attentive, I know you. Even if you can't know that I know you care, if that doesn't somehow illuminate our world with the presence of Christ, then we're just not paying attention. Or we just believe something that's keeping us from the possibility of seeing just how ever-present God is in the world. It's not a happy story that happened in the midst of. You know, it's a sad story. It's a hard story. Tyrion's going to have a long, rough ride with this. He's, of all of our kids, his personality is the one that will bring this back to him, probably the most acutely and the most often. It's going to be heavy going. That story is going to help. It's going to not just help now, it's going to help over and over again. It's going to keep carrying care back into this. It's huge. It's hugely important. And then when the same person was cleaning up Taya's room, when Taya's a creative energizer bunny, okay, like she just churns out stuff. And it's her way of processing the world, I think, a lot of times. And so she likes to sew, and so there's a little sewing machine and all this fabric in her room. And when she makes something, it kind of ends up in a pile over there, and then she moves on to the next project, and there's a pile over here, and then there's this bunch of fabric over there. Well, this woman had separated all these projects, these little piles of fabric. She had them all kind of identified and cataloged, and she was dealing with all of them. And she asked Corrine, who came into the room, she said, "This is sort of how they were, and we'd like to put them back, but that's going to be a little bit difficult with the fabric because it's kind of hard to tell one bit from another. Do you think it would be okay if I combined all of these and just kind of kept all the fabric together?" Same kind of care, right? Same kind of attention to the experience of the person on the other end of this, if you will. I started thinking about that and thinking about the way God is characterized in Scripture and the care of God is characterized in Scripture. And it took me to a well-known song, a piece of music, a libretto, at least a lyric for a song. Listen to this. In light of those stories, "You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit down, when I rise. You know, you perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You're familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before. You lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Only you can do that. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you." The language of the psalm reminds me of another little incident. Sunday night, Corrine and I are in bed, and we're in Richard and Deanna's bed, our neighbor's bed, and we're laying there in bed. Corrine says to me, "This is weird." I'm like, "What's weird?" She said, "We're in Richard and Deanna's bed." Said, "Yeah, and they don't know." Because we hadn't been able to be in touch with them. They were in transit to Mexico at the time. We cleared all this with their kids who were local. And met the same response from all of them, by the way. They didn't only give us permission, they actually used their words again. "No, we insist." So, anyway, the care there has been awesome, too. But no matter where I make my bed, literally or poetically, is what where that imagery kind of, you know, keeps going for me. There, God knows. And God is there. And if that bed-making, if that seeking of a place to call home, and we're struggling with our language in our household right now, right? Like, what do we call these spaces? And Corrine said to Kale the other day, "Do you need to go home and get something?" And he said, "That's the house. Where you guys are, that's home. Where we are, that's home." So is it Richard's and the house? Is it the house and home? Is it, you know, and it just reflects the struggle, right? And I mean, this is us struggling with generosity. We're not struggling with homelessness. We might kind of feel displaced and be displaced in certain ways, and that's true, and it comes with its own challenges, but my goodness, if I think about the implications of this truth, I think about the size of the ripple that this carries into culture and into displacedness, and I think about the kind of hope that comes with knowing that there is somewhere to lay my head that is warm enough and safe enough and provided for enough. and I think about what a gift that's been in our lives, and I think about the people for whom that gift is not present at the end of the day. And then I think about the way Christ has been carried to us by so many kind people in this, and I think, what are the implications of that? What am I supposed to be taking away? And by supposed to be taking away, you need to know, my theology does not include the idea of God causing this fire. And I'll get to that. But that's not where I'm going when I talk about what am I supposed to be taking away. I'm not talking about God lighting my house on fire because there's something for me to learn. And there's lots of theology that would run like that. That's why I mention it. Attendant to that reminder of the everywhere presence of God, I've been reminded in a renewed way of the importance of kindness, of kindness, of this common ground that I have with every human, that the people in this story are all kin, they're all family. Not in some vague sense, but in the sense of we need one another and we should care for one another, that we belong to one another in humanity. And there were so many concrete, immediate illustrations of this. The fire chief, the first man on the scene, he was awesome. When Corrine got there, she was the first of our family to be there because I went to the hospital first to see the boys. He wouldn't let her walk anywhere without him. And it wasn't about some kind of policy. He just gave her his arm. And just everywhere she needed to go, he just went there. And he said to her, if you need to cry, you just go ahead. It's fine, you know, but things are slippery and you just need to stay with me. How lovely. Okay? Big burly guy in his turnout gear. Seeing Corrine around the house. She was, you know, granny. Awesome. His buddy Andy, with whom he was having breakfast. Oh, well, how many of you have been to our place? This will make the most sense to those of you that have been there. So you've seen the driveway, it's not a real big curve, right? It's a fairly tight curve. They had to fit a fire truck in there. So they did, but they couldn't fit it back out. And so the fire truck was stuck in the driveway, which meant they had, and this was full of water, you know, 16,000 gallon truck or whatever. So they weren't going anywhere. They had to get this humongous loader in there. And they probably changed the curve of the driveway a little. But anyway, so they dug this thing out, and they did clear the snow all that they needed to clear out of the way with this massive machine. And it made a mess of its own, of course, the way these things go. So we're all there a little later, just kind of poking around and trying to assess the damage and get our bearings. And all of a sudden we look out the window and there's this guy out there on a quad with a blade on the front. And he's tidying up. I'm like, who the heck is that? You know, where did he come from, right? His quad's falling out of the sky now. So he kind of cleans up all the mess this loader made, and then he goes away. It turns out it's Andy, this other fireman who lives just down the road. And he thought, you know, when we asked him about it later, he said, well, you know, I thought amidst of all the other things you guys are worrying about, you really shouldn't have to worry about getting stuck in your own driveway. So I just thought I'd kind of come back and tidy up. That's kindness. It wasn't Andy's responsibility as a volunteer firefighter or anything else. It was somebody behaving like kin. When, you know, the genealogical tree wouldn't be diagrammed that way. Super important. Presence of Christ again. And I've been challenged in a renewed and a really personal way about my perspective on these sort of grand questions of a loving God and suffering. It's been pretty interesting having conversations with people about this. This could sound like a pity party, and it's not. It's really been fine. But it's been an interesting chronicle. So the last few months kind of ran like this. So it's about just over the last half a year. Corrine's mom died. About the same week we found out that was a terminal thing. Her dad was diagnosed with cancer and queued up for chemo. My dad was in very heavy chemo rotation, which resulted in the middle of summer in him having a severe stroke. We thought we were going to lose him. Both dads are still around, and that's fantastic. It wasn't very long after that that we hit a deer with our van and rode it off, decided to get it fixed anyway, so we got it fixed. And 4 days after we got it back from the body shop, the engine blew. That was early December. Now the house. So people who know this story are starting to kind of add things up, you know? And so I'm having this conversation with this friend of mine who knows all these little niggly bits of our life. And he says, that's kind of starting to sound Jobian. Kind of like the story of Job. And then he said, man, I hate that story. I thought, well, that's strong, let's talk. And so we start having this conversation about it. And I should say, before I get into this part of what I want to talk about, that honestly, you guys, if any of these events had involved the loss of one of my kids, my ability to be philosophical about this would be so compromised that, you know, I don't know what that would mean. I honestly, I hope you can keep the chronicle that I just gave you in some perspective. I'm trying to. Sometimes I succeed, sometimes I don't. But I know there's suffering and then there's suffering. So let's just, I think that's important. But he kind of felt like it was Job. And so that got us talking about Job a little bit. And why he hated the story so much. I don't know how familiar you are with Job. Most of us don't read it for fun. But I mean, it starts out with this kind of conversation between God and Satan, right? Satan kind of going, ah, your servant Job, you know, he says he loves you and all this business, but it's just because look what he's got. So give me permission and I'm gonna sift him. I'm gonna test him. God says in Job, you go ahead, you'll find out he's the real deal. And when we started talking about that, I realized fairly quickly, you know, this friend of mine was reading Job like it was biography. He was reading Job like it was Western history, like it was a chronicle of events in the heavens, but in time and space, like we think of time and space. I said, you know, buddy, what would happen if you read that story like what I think it is, like a stage play, like a piece of theater? It doesn't bear the hallmarks of history the way we think of history at all, as a piece of literature. What would happen if you did that? He said, this guy's grown up in church. He said, I've never heard anybody say that before. I've never thought of that before. I thought, well, this is not that unique an idea. It's not unique to me. It's not original to me. But I think it's really important. If we think about the story of Job as a piece of theater, as a stage play, as a piece of art, it doesn't have anything less to say, but it does speak with a different voice. And if we think about it that way, what does it have to say? What's the point? The point is not that somewhere in the heavenlies there is a literal dialogue between God and Satan in which God gives Satan permission to beat Job's life to a pulp. That's the setup. Anybody who's ever written a story or tried to write a story knows you've got to have a setup. You've got to have a breakdown somewhere that needs redress. So you've got a breakdown. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story is where the arc of the story takes us to, and where the arc of the story takes us to, and it travels through all our standard religious takes on suffering and what's going on, right? Because man, our drive to say what does this mean is enormous. That's built into humanity. We want to make sense of the world around us. We need some kind of grid for this. And if suffering is what we're experiencing, then we need a grid for suffering. That's why we kind of keep asking why. You know, with such perennialness, if that's even a word. Why we can't seem to stop asking the why question, even though our head knows it's not a very helpful question and not really answerable. Anyway, Job's friends, of course, truck through all that terrain, right? Why? Well, because you sinned. Why? Because you didn't keep the rules. Why? Because whatever. You know, so there's all these different whys, right? That sort of takes up a bunch of the middle. And then at the end of the book, about chapter 38 or so, God like turns into, he just goes on a rant, you know, just like drops it into gear and starts letting it fly. And the essence of what God has to say to Job at the end of Job, and it takes a few chapters to get through all the illustrations of the point is, you're not me. And not only can you not order the cosmos, not only can you not make sense of the grand order of things, but you know what, Job? You can't even make sense of the order of creation. And when I kind of rethought that in the context of this little event, I thought, yeah, that's right. I can't make sense of this in real time and space, never mind in the cosmos. That's not my gig. And the point of the book of Job is, that's not my gig. It's God saying, you're not me. Don't lose your place in the story. You weren't even there when I got the whole ball rolling. You can't even toss a hook in the water and haul in a Leviathan. Whatever that is, it's big, right? You're out of your depth already, and you haven't even left home. Where were you? God starts in 38 verse 4. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Tell me if you understand. You know? Now, let's go from there, because this is where you live, and you already don't know how it works. We don't know what energy is. We know how it behaves. We don't know what gravity is. We know how it behaves. Do I need to keep going? It's a good piece of theater, because it tells the truth. And I was reminded of that again in these events. This is not my gig. And if I try to make that stuff my gig, I am going to mismake my world. My job is to press into the mystery of the God that knows all of that. My job is to get to know that being as much as it is up to me. That being reaches toward me. This is the Christian story. This is at the heart of the Christian story, is God initiating being known over and over and over again in whatever way actually fits with what's going on in the culture. God gets that we're limited knowers. God gets that our context is where we learn things. And that's one of the reasons why I believe so seriously that God will find a way to be known. And that way will look different in different cultures at different times. Because God is utterly determined to initiate with God's creation. Not so that we will be able to, in some formulaic way, answer all of life's great questions, but so that in the midst of life's great questions, we will be with God and know that God is with us. It's a really curious thing to me that when I study theologies of suffering in the Western world, they often kind of revolve around why. I study them in other parts of the world where there's a lot more suffering, where there's been more suffering for a long time. And guess what? Those theologians are not actually trying to answer that question nearly as often as the Western theologians. They're actually trying to find out what it means to suffer well. And that's where they say they touch the presence of God. What does it mean to not smirch the name of God in my suffering? How can I learn that? Because that's where I'm going to encounter the glory of God. Interesting, eh? Kalen and David Falk are friends of ours that I mentioned sort of obliquely earlier, who lost their entire home and its contents. And their older son, Jace, is a really good friend of our son, Kale. And often in our home, he's kind of like one of those extension kids of our family, you know. Oh, Jace, you're here. Did you bring cookies, or are you going to make some? Like, he just kind of lives there when he comes over. It's pretty awesome. And so after their house fire, Jace and Kale and his mom were having this conversation one day, and Jace would have been about 14 at the time, I guess. Said to his mom, he said, Mom, why would God allow something like this to happen? What does it mean? This is the why question, right? Kaylin said to him, she said, Jace, it means you are alive. That's what it means. What does suffering mean? It means you're alive. What? That sounds a little bleak. Yeah, life is nasty, brutish, and short. It's full stop, you know? And what she was after in her wisdom was to try to find a way to say to her son, who was suffering, in life we suffer. If we're suffering, it's one of the ways we know we're alive. It's not the only way we know we're alive. Ecstasy tells us we're alive as well. Joy tells us we're alive as well. Hope tells us we're alive as well. So does despair, by the way. Dark and light. What did the psalmist have to say just a few minutes ago? If the darkness is, if I'm just surrounded by it, if I'm just buried in it, is it possible that somehow you could make that behave like light? I can't. That's the message of Job. I can't. That part of the way this cosmic thing works is not up to me. That's God-sized stuff. But what if God's business is coming into places where it is all dark, so that it is no longer all dark? And how much light would that need to be exactly before it was no longer all dark? Well, theoretically, any amount at all. It's interesting. It's a different perspective, isn't it? Jesus in John, with his disciples, he's kind of trying to help them understand that he's going to leave, and they're just not getting it. And John 16, Jesus has just cataloged this long list of ways in which things are about to get more difficult. Just this grocery list of suffering. And then after he's kind of cataloged all of this, he offers this little study in contrasts and comfort. He says to his disciples, I've told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. Now, we can spend a lot of time in the context for those words because, again, I think they often get misapplied. I think we can camp out on overcoming as though it were, how can I say this? A uniquely religious form of aggressive denial of suffering. That what Jesus meant there is, if you love me, you shouldn't suffer. But it doesn't work, does it? In this world, you will have trouble. It's fairly straightforward. It's not a metaphor. It's not an anything. It's just a bald-faced declaration of the nature of the world. And yet, there's this hope and possibility of peace, all those things. Paul, writing post-Jesus and kind of working with these things in his time and culture, writing to the Corinthian church, who have been under real duress. There's been some real hardship, and a lot of it's had to do with resources. He says this about the nature of suffering and caring for others. He says, our desire is not that others might be relieved while you were hard-pressed, but that there might be equality. At the present time, your plenty will supply what they need, so that in turn, their plenty will supply what you need. The goal is equality, as it is written, the one who gathered much did not have too much, and the one who gathered little did not have too little. If you ever need to find a text that addresses itself to the distribution of wealth, then there's a good one right there. But it's about the distribution of many things, isn't it? But among them, care, and the mystery that casts us into. Maybe there is enough. And the question is whether we're carrying it to where it's needed or not, whether we're kind of doing our part with this. I was having a conversation with my mom yesterday morning at breakfast. We're sitting in this wonderful home. We're warm on a cold night. Chris, the son of the people who own the home, had phoned us that morning to say, it was quite a lot of snow last night, so I brought a loader home from work. I'm coming over this morning to clear the drive. Okay, Chris, bring it on. Shows up with a loader, like, I don't know, a third of the size of this space, this just massive Volvo front-end loader, and, you know, does what would have taken me a week. It was awesome. We're feeling really cared for, you know, in that moment. My mom's story is that she grew up with a dad who was crippled by disease in his early 20s in the Depression. Hard times. It was hard times all the way through the story. And we were talking about how you process sitting here at this table, you know, cared for in the middle of his events, and how do you make of it? What do you do with that? When we both know full well that it's not a rule that it would be so. And my mom, who isn't really inclined to unpacking this stuff all that much, referenced her own story, and she said, and I don't think I've ever heard her say anything like this, quite this forthrightly before, she said, you know, I imagine my thinking about this is really impacted by my own story. You think? You know, yeah. She said, but when good things happen like this in the middle of difficult things, she said, there's some kind of line inside of me that says you don't need to make sense out of this, you just need to receive it. She said, I could have been batting my head around this question for the last 50 years. But in that earlier experience, there was something in me that realized, these are questions that I just can't answer. I can't answer them either way. I can't answer them about suffering, and I can't answer them about blessing, if we want to use that language. These things come. We don't actually get to know just how and why. But it was fascinating to hear her take on the receiving of what is good as being framed the same way as the receiving of what is difficult. Either way, I am cast into mystery, and either way, it's not my deal to answer all the questions about it. My deal is to live well with it. And I thought that was a fantastic piece of wisdom, and it was a lovely moment with my mom. I wouldn't go so far, because I don't have a character, as to say I'd light my house on fire again just to have that moment, but it was pretty big. I wanna leave us this morning with a little bit of poetry, actually. It's not, for those of you who may fear this temp, sentimental poetry. It's Gerard Manley Hopkins. It's good, robust poetry. It's a fragment of a poem. It's actually untitled. It's from some of his unfinished work. But it has a couple of images in it that I found really helpful this week. So listen to this, and I'll sort of stop and talk a little bit. I know that can ruin a perfectly good poem. But I'm reading you this poem to make application of it. And so if you're a lover of poetry, please forgive my heavy hand. The first stanza, though, just so we can enjoy the stanza on its own. How many of you know what a mote is? M-O-T-E, mote, not M-O-A-T, mote. Just not, you don't need to, okay. It's not a common English word, but it is still in currency. If we look, if the light was shining low angle in through the windows of this room, and we looked at the beam of light from the side, we would see things floating in it. What's floating in it are motes, dust motes in this case, okay? The little things that float in the air. Okay, you need to know that word for this stanza. There's not one like that in every stanza. Thee, God, I come from. To thee go. All day long I like fountain flow from thy hand out, swayed about, mote-like, in thy mighty glow. What I know of thee I bless, as acknowledging thy stress on my being and as seeing something of thy holiness. Once I turned from thee and hid, bound on what thou hadst forbid, so the wind I would, I sinned, I repent of what I did. Bad I am, but yet thy child. Father, be thou reconciled, spare thou me, since I see with thy might that thou art mild. I have life before me still, and thy purpose to fulfill. Yea, a debt to pay thee yet. Help me, sir, and so I will. But thou bidst, and just thou art, me show mercy from my heart towards my brother, every other man, my mate and counterpart. The last stanza is less complex when you look at it than when you hear it. I want to leave a phrase out because he says, but thou bidst, and just thou art, me show mercy, and the me feels awkward to us, the way we would speak. So if we leave out, and just thou art, which is an important idea, I'm not leaving out the idea, but let's leave out the phrase for a moment. But thou bidst me show mercy from my heart towards my brother, every other man, my mate and counterpart. But somehow, in this grand thing we call life, in which things that are both wondrous and things that are terrible and things that are all a muddle of the two happen, this is the bidding of God. Hopkins pins it in this poem for me. We come from God. It's to God we go. We float like dust motes in the glow of what God has made. We're just these tiny, yet utterly remarkable, wondrous bits in the universe. Yet somehow, all of that we are flows out from God our Maker, and we are invited to come back to God our Maker. And when we come back, among the other things that we encounter is the fact that we are not all that we ought to be, that there is work to be done, but that we do that work in the presence of a God who is both mighty and very, very gentle with that might, very kind with that might. Which could bring us back to what I think are the misreadings of Job, right? If we miss the big arc of the story, then we just need to pay attention to whatever else is going on. And we do have life before us still. There are things that we are made for, that we are made to do, called to do, and invited to do. And somewhere in there, a just God says to us, one of the frameworks for how you will process both what is lovely and unlovely, what is difficult and what is awesome, is that everyone is a counterpart. That every, and he uses male language here, but towards my brother, every other man, my mate and counterpart. That's kindness, kindness. That's where being the presence of Christ becomes the thing that we are made to do. And when it is, when we do it, we experience meaning in profound ways. We experience purpose in profound ways. And when it is done to us, we have the same experience. We feel like, oh, that's right. We might all just be dancing dust motes compared to the glory of God, but somehow in that dance, we are charged with carrying enormous things to one another, not least of all, the presence of Christ. And when it is carried to us, we are charged with receiving it with open hearts, open lives. They can both be challenging, right? It's not always easy to be on the receiving end, I've found. But when we open our lives to it, we're doing what we're made to do. Our gig is to wrestle for perspective, to acknowledge that we're not God. We don't know the answers to the cosmic questions. But we are able to receive the mercy of God with gratitude, and we are able to pass it on to others in a way that acknowledges, or that is meant to acknowledge, that every other person is my mate, my counterpart. In the middle of our version of suffering these days, those are some of the things that I feel like God is graciously reminding me of and teaching me, reteaching me. I don't expect that has either started with this or will stop with this, but I'm grateful for this particular shape of it in this season of life, and I hope that those things can be a gift to us all as a community. Amen.